Professor Chris Kinnean is a criminologist and he focuses on First Nations people and the law, including restorative justice, policing and prison issues. Chris has been part of a number of Royal Commissions and inquiries, including the Stolen Generations Inquiry, Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody and the National Inquiry into Racist Violence. He's taught criminology at several law schools around the country and was director of the Institute of Criminology at the University of Sydney. These days, he's Professor of Criminology with the Jumbana Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at UTS. Chris has a lot of interesting work that we could be chatting about, but this time we're focusing on Call It Out, the First Nations Racism Register and the National Justice Reinvestment Program.
Yeah, look, it was a few years ago and I remember meeting with George Newhouse from National Justice Project, and we both had similar ideas about the importance of setting up some sort of register, which was national, which would record incidents of racism against First Nations people. And it really evolved from there. We kind of spent quite a bit of time setting it up because we didn't have any funding to do it. And so we had to rely on pro bono assistance. But it was really, I suppose, generated by the fact that there was no national register for recording incidents of racism. There'd been things like surveys done, and there still are surveys done, but we wanted to set something up which was actually an archive, if you like, of racism, which was being reported directly by First Nations people and would be there to sort of stand the test of time as opposed to a single survey. And there's lots of other things about how we set it up which I think are important. I mean, one is that it allows people to write a narrative, to tell their story on the register as opposed to a survey where you tick a box. And so what we've found over the last couple of years since the register's been running is that those narratives are extremely important. As one person said, they're cathartic for themselves in terms of being able to write what's happened to them, but also I think just in terms of seeing the depth of the experiences, the intergenerational aspects of racism, which you don't never get on a survey. And so it's been really, really important from that point of view.
Can you give some examples of the kinds of experiences that are captured on the register?
Yeah, look, I mean, it varies so much from people in the workplace where their culture is denigrated to, you know, violent incidents. One that sticks out is a mum with her two kids sitting out on their front veranda in summer in inner city Sydney. Which happened to be down from a pub, and a group of people coming out, non-Aboriginal people coming out of the pub, yelling abuse at them while they were just sitting in the front yard, as well as damaging their car. Other examples of a very young child being racially abused, and examples of older woman being knocked to the ground. So violent responses, and then as well as sort of institutional responses in the workplace, examples in hospitals of treatment, racist treatment. And I think one of the other things about the register that's important, which also goes to these stories, is the register allows third-party witnesses to record what they've seen. And so in some of the hospital settings, we had non-Aboriginal doctors and nurses also record the way in which Aboriginal patients had been treated. So there's a multitude of stories. We've got now over 2 years, just under 1,000 registrations. So you can imagine the spectrum, everywhere from a football match to being a hospital patient, being in the workplace to being in the street in terms of the incidence of racism.
The register would capture some instances that would be prohibited under law, that would be, you know, would breach laws against racial discrimination, and some in contexts where they wouldn't, because it covers any kind. Are you seeing, when you look at the data, that actually the places where racism is experienced might not be covered by legislation?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the register is that we allow people to define what's happened to them as being racist, not providing, you know, the parameters of a legal definition. And I think it's not always straightforward in terms of the descriptions that are there as to whether they would fall under the legislation or not. But there are, you know, a variety of incidents, and certainly incidents that could be reported. And one of the questions we ask people is whether they reported to any of the anti-discrimination bodies or the Australian Human Rights Commission. And only 5% of the people actually had reported it. So it's the levels of reporting are very low, but we can't tell from that actually how many might have fallen within the legislation or might be outside of it. But we do know that there's – what most people do is talk to their family and talk to their friends about what happened to them. I mean, that's the most common response rather than taking any formal action.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people who've been through a traumatic experience like that don't want to actually go through the formal process. And this gives them a chance to, as you say, tell their story, share their experience, highlight an issue without having to go through the process of a formal complaint mechanism, whether that's in their workplace or some other body.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's an important part of what's captured, if you like, on the register. Most people don't make any complaints. They talk to their family. But also in relation to the complaints processes, a sizable proportion of people said that they didn't know what to do. You know, they didn't know that they could do anything about it. Another group said, well, they didn't believe anything would be done if they went through a process. So I think both of those things sort of influence the low levels of reporting.
Does this give you a sense of the fact that there is a kind of structural racism in society, if you're seeing it in so many different contexts? Does it give you a sense from looking at the register how widespread systemic and structural racism are in the country?
Look, I think it does. And one of the things that we set out to capture when we set up the register was the idea of systemic racism or institutional racism. And some people identified what had happened to them as being part of structural racism, but not everybody did. But one of the things, important things about having a narrative is when you read the narrative, you can see whether these are systemic issues that aren't being addressed. And certainly, you know, there's no doubt, I think, just in terms of the variety of incidents of racism that have been reported, that there is this much bigger structural problem in relation to racism across all areas of society. You know, we might think of racism as being the kind of public place where people are physically or verbally abused, but there are many other types of incidents that occur, as I've said, within the workplace or within hospitals, within schools, a whole kind of gamut, if you like, of the institutional framework within which we live.
Anecdotally, we've heard that a lot of people have experienced or felt that there's been a much more aggressive or visible expression of racism as a result of the referendum and the dialogue around that. Has anything around that been picked up in what you're seeing in the register?
Yeah, look, to some extent we haven't analysed the more recent data which would relate to the referendum, the latter part of the referendum period anyway. But certainly one of the areas that comes out quite strongly is around social media and the virulent and violent expressions that are there, racist expressions that are there. And I think that's an important area that's captured on the register. And certainly some of the people that have made registrations have pointed or indicated to that what they see as a growing level of virulent racism through the media and through social media.
You already mentioned that one of the outcomes of people using the register is that they can tell their story, they can tell it in a way it's comfortable to them. They might not want to go through a formal process. But from your perspective, once you've correlated the information and the data, you've seen the stories that are coming through, what are some of the strategies or actions you have in terms of change or advocacy that might flow from the information that comes through the register?
Yeah, a couple of areas stand out straight away. I mean, one is if only 5% of people are reporting, that should be a huge wake-up call to anti-discrimination bodies in terms of reaching out to enable people both to have the knowledge and to be able to engage in the process if they choose to. The other area, though, that's been of particular interest to us is the relationship between the register and community activism at a local level. And we've talked about this as a group. We want to be able to promote the register at a community level. And we can't do that at the moment because we don't have the resources to do it. But we know quite well if we were to go and stand on a corner in Moree or in Bourke or in Halls Creek or in Alice Springs and collect people's stories, we would have an explosion in terms of the registrations. But we don't have the facilities to do that at the moment. We also want to be able to give that information back to community. So at a community level, people can actually develop their own strategies to combat racism at a local level. And we've been influenced by, you know, going back through the longer stretch of history to the Freedom Rides. And we know when Charlie Perkins and students went out in the bus, they went and visited certain areas, and the students had a little questionnaire that they took to people, which people filled in about the nature of racism in the community. And that was a really important way of gathering it. What we're looking at now, you know, as a 21st century version of this, is basically a digital version where you're actually able to record these incidents of racism via a register. But to enable that to work properly, we also need to go out to community to enable people to know about the register, to be able to collect that information and to be able to use it at a local level. It may be that, you know, in Moree or in Bourke or wherever, having that knowledge about the main problems of racism recorded provides the kind of basis, if you like, to develop a strategy, whether it's a strategy around school expulsions or suspensions, whether it's a strategy around the way healthcare is delivered through the local hospital, or whether it's a strategy around the local government, the local council, better responding to Aboriginal needs. And so there's a sort of formal area about how the law works and how the institutions of the law work in relation to racism. But I think, from my point of view anyway, there's a much more important strategy, which is about developing community activism and advocacy at a local level.
If people are listening and would like to use the register to make a complaint, or, as you say, to lodge an incident that they've actually observed, how can they access the register? Where do they go to find those resources?
So the URL is callitout, one word, .com.au. And I'll also give a quick plug to a mobile app, which we've been busily working on. And within the next month, anyway, we'll have a mobile app where you can also register any incidents of racism.
I want to now turn to another aspect of your work, which is actually very centred on structural change within the system, and that is the justice reinvestment work you've been doing. And I wonder if we could just start with you giving us a bit of an overview about what the concept of justice reinvestment is.
Yeah, look, the concept of justice reinvestment in many ways is around a community development approach to dealing with criminal justice issues. And as an idea, it was developed in the early 2000s in the US, but it was picked up in Australia by social justice commissioners, Tom Carmer, Mick Gooder, and it kind of gelled here in Australia because it aligned with ideas around self-determination, that the people who know how to answer the problems in relation to criminalisation, over-imprisonment and so forth is really people at a community level. And what justice reinvestment does is provide the opportunity for communities to develop their own strategies to deal with justice issues. It doesn't ignore the big picture. The big picture is still there. It may be that legislative change is required, say, in relation to bail laws. So it's not ignoring that bigger picture, but it's also working at a community level in terms of what can be done at that local level in relation to policing, in relation to child removal, in relation to the courts. And so the idea, as it was originally generated, was to argue that the money that's being spent on the criminal justice system, on locking people up, all those areas which we know don't work, we know that recidivism rates show that quite clearly. Sending someone to jail just means that they go back to jail. And so it was really about diverting some of that huge expense that goes into the criminal justice system back to communities to develop their own approaches. So that's the kind of basic idea of it.
And in the work that you've been doing, what have been some actual examples on the ground that you've seen of communities trying to take this approach?
One example where we've been doing some work recently is with the Elders for Change in Townsville, which are a group of women, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, which have been providing support to women in prison for years without any funding. They do it as volunteers. And they recently received some funding now to develop what they do at the local level to support people, women, and they're also looking at men in prison. And in terms of post-release, they're also looking at the bigger picture. For people who know Townsville, it has a reputation as being a redneck and vigilante-style community, and so there's a great deal of tension in that community, particularly around the allegations around Aboriginal young people. And so they're looking at ways in which they can work directly in resolving some of those problems at the local level. Lots of other examples I could give. Halls Creek, again, is a you know, in Western Australia, an example of a community that's been particularly focused on young people, but also attempting to kind of bring young Aboriginal young people in Halls Creek into the sphere of elders. And so there's an elders space for the men where young people can go to and spend time. They have like a night patrol for young people as well. And they also provide assistance out to the outlying communities, small outlying communities around Halls Creek. And many of those communities have very, very little support of any sort. And so developing this at a local level with justice reinvestment support has been really important for them.
Have you seen positive change as a result of it? Is there an evidence base now that justice reinvestment is working?
I think the one that's normally referred to as Burke, where it's been operating for a decade or more, in terms of reducing time spent in cells, improving educational outcomes in terms of retention rates in the high school, lowering rates of domestic violence. There's been various evaluations done now in Burke, and you know, the results are positive.
You reviewed the government's new justice reinvestment program last year. What did you find?
So what we've done is we've been working with the Attorney General's Department, Jumbana and Ninty One. So Aboriginal-focused organisations have been working with the Attorney General's Department to develop justice reinvestment at a community level. And so we've been spending much of the last 12 months working with communities, first to apply for funding. We know that, you know, a community like Aboriginal elders in Newman or Aboriginal elders in Papunya or wherever, you know, don't necessarily have the resources to fill in a government application for funding. And so we've been going out to communities to assist people in actually applying for money. And if they get the money, then assisting them with actually developing the programs that they want. And, you know, as you would appreciate, both applying for funding through a government process is difficult, and then actually implementing some of these things needs assistance. You can't expect people might have the ideas, but they don't necessarily know the processes to put in place to get things done. So that's the work that we've been doing.
Well, I think people are always interested to know what is actually going to work, and you often hear people who are genuinely interested in First Nations issues say, if we knew what can work, then that's what we'll support to do. But you mentioned that this happens in a broader context. And I wonder, given the length of time you've worked in the criminology space, what your impression has been overall of whether things are getting better, where have they improved, and where have you actually seen entrenched problems that haven't shifted?
It's easy to be negative, really easy to be negative about the way the criminal justice system works. You feel as though for every, you know, one step forward, you take two steps back. Maybe sometimes you take two steps forward and only one step back. But, you know, it's a process. And I think there's always a struggle with state and territory governments around criminal justice issues. Every time there's an election, every time there's a particular incident that occurs, you have the immediate knee-jerk reactions. We're seeing it, you know, we've seen it in the Northern Territory. We've seen it in Queensland recently as well. With changes to bail legislation as an example. I don't think that's a reason to stop, because I think working around models of community empowerment are important, intrinsically important in themselves. Even if the governments, you know, even if you can't control what governments do, if you can assist communities to work in this area and to develop their own strategies, then I think that's a win in itself.
Well, I have to say, as I mentioned earlier, I've known you for a very long time, too polite to say how long. And I've always been impressed by the fact that you continue to work in this really tough space. As you say, some things feel like they're intractable, and the evidence base doesn't counter the ideological approaches that you see around, like you said, in the lead up to elections or when there seems to be some kind of focus in the media on a particular issue. But you always seem to be very optimistic and continue to be positive about the contribution you can make. Where does that positivity come from?
Look, I think it comes from people, you know, from other people, that optimism of working at a community level. That's what kind of generates my energy around it. I was, you know, out at Newman, been out to Newman in the Pilbara in Western Australia twice in the last 2 months or 6 weeks, I think, working with the elders group out there, the Tribal Council, Matu Tribal Council for Justice Reinvestment, and mostly working with the men. There's also a women's group in, as part of that tribal council as well. But, yeah, I think just the inspiration that you get at a local level keeps you optimistic.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for your energy, your work, and for joining us on Speaking Out.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
That's Professor of Criminology at the Jumbana Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney, Chris Kinnean. And the Call It Out website is callitout.com.au. And a new app has just been released to make reporting even more accessible. And you can find that app on Apple or Google, where you get your apps from.